Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Life is filled with mysteries for high school seniors and their parents. The inscrutable world of college admissions is a big one. Each fall, seniors put their hands in the fates of the admissions gods and pray. And for good reason, even perfect scores and varsity letters won't necessarily cinch a spot in the freshman class. Tonight's guest, New York Times national education correspondent Jacques Steinberg, spent almost a year tracking the inside story of college admissions and says there's a reason it's mysterious. Colleges make their admissions decisions, says Steinberg, behind a cordon of security befitting the selection of a pope. This country hasn't always been so college-crazed, but competition to gain admission to top-tier schools has grown ever more intense over the past two decades. Steinberg went inside the admissions system to see how one school winnowed 700 students for the class of 2004 out of 7,000 applicants. He got the inside story on how test scores, social class, grades, race, connections, and sports add up to the decisions that shape lives. So what has your family's college admissions experience been like? Does it work? Is it fair? We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Joining me from Seattle, Washington, to demystify this college admissions process for all of us is Jacques Steinberg, national education correspondent for the New York Times. He spent 8 months as an observer inside the admissions office of one of the most selective colleges in the country, Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. His findings are now a book entitled The Gatekeepers, Inside the Admissions Process of a Premier College. Good evening and welcome, Jacques Steinberg.
Good evening, Tom. Thanks.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
It's good to have you, Jack. Jacques Steinberg, you say that the admissions process is akin to the picking of the selection of a pope. What do you mean?
Well, you know, they notoriously and sort of historically have kept this process private and secret. Soon after they admit a lot of kids, they will shred those records so that nobody sees evidence of that, of these decisions.
So
it's just too conduct the materials that they are sort of mixing, the elements are just too combustible. The things you sort of said in the introduction, race, social class, connections, athletics, there is very little benefit for an institution to sort of show this to a wider audience. It's too messy.
So very few of us, almost none of us, sit around the table of the admissions officers as you did, follow the admissions officers on their beat throughout the application season as you did. After that long experience, and granted this is at one college, it's in the Northeast, and we'll talk about how that may or may not shape what you saw there. But what, in your view, Jacques, is there a gap between perception and reality in how Americans understand college admissions?
I think there is, and I think that gap is posed in part by a number of books that sort of promise to give you the inside scoop on how to get in. Some of them have even called, you know, sort of like things like The Truth About Getting In. They imply that there is a secret formula out there, that if we could figure it out, we could gain admission to these schools. Wesleyan is actually not all that different from schools like Harvard and Yale and Stanford and Princeton and Dartmouth in terms of the basic way that it conducts its admissions. And if there's a secret formula, I just never could find it.
Of course, everyone's trying to put their finger on it when they help their child put the applications packet together. Everyone's hoping to find that golden ring.
I think that if there's one thing that I learned from the year that I spent at Wesleyan, as described in The Gatekeepers, it's that this process is so much more messy and idiosyncratic and unpredictable and at times arbitrary and personal to the particular admissions officers involved than you've read in any of these how to get in guides. It really is very, very hard to generalize about, and it's very hard to out-strategize.
So take us into the texture of it then. You spent 8 months, I guess. Tell us exactly how you were able to observe the admissions process here and the kind of flow of the system as it went from 7,000 applicants to 700 matriculated new students.
Well, first of all, Wesleyan University did an incredible thing, and sort of here's this process that is so secret, as I said, that there, where records are shredded soon after decisions are made, never to be discussed again. And Wesleyan brought us into the room at the request of the New York Times. In part, they were acting, you know, so boldly because they are very proud of the way they practice affirmative action in particular, and sort of wanted the world to know how they did this. They felt in the hands of a fair and accurate reporter, which they hoped I would be, that they'd get the word out. But also, they're a perennial also-ran behind the schools like Williams and Amherst in the U.S. News rankings, the all-important U.S. News rankings. Mm-hmm. And I thought they thought by being bold, they might pick up some applications and perhaps vault up the rankings of U.S. News. Once I was inside, I was able to follow one admissions officer in particular, a gentleman named Ralph Figueroa.
Who we will speak with in a few minutes.
Oh, terrific. And when that process was over, I had seen hundreds of decisions. So Wesleyan really had no idea who I was interested in because I was just there so much. I then went and contacted six of the applicants who now knew their fates and got their permission to write about them in the Gatekeepers using their real names and the real details of their files.
So you saw from both sides, both from the admissions officer's perspective and from the applicant's perspective.
Right. And the book really flows chronologically, that you meet the kids in the book, you meet them as they meet Ralph, all of their files crossed Ralph's desk at a certain point in the process, and then you follow their applications right into the decision room. Sometimes the decision is really sealed when Ralph is reading on the porch of his home with the heat off to sort of keep himself awake as he's reading 30 files a day for 8 weeks. Sometimes the decision doesn't come until very contested sort of committee hearings where Ralph and his colleagues are sitting around a boardroom table, sometimes arguing. And then you're there when the kids receive the letter, and you're there as they try to figure out what they're going to do. Ultimately, because this was the class of 2004, the book has an epilogue that shows you the first 2 years of their college careers. Mm-hmm. Some of them are at Wesleyan, some of them are not. Some of them make it, and some of them drop out.
What's your sense, Jacques Steinberg, from that 8-month immersion in U.S. college admissions? What is admirable about the way American students are chosen for college today, and what's not?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to decide as an observer of this process, every parent and sort of politician and observer, consumer has to decide, do you want these decisions to be made by a computer? That's certainly the way that the big public universities have to do it because there's such a volume of applications and so little resources that you feed SAT scores and GPA and class rank and other factors into a computer and you get a class. You and I are talking here today about maybe 50 sort of elite private colleges out of a universe of 2,000 four-year colleges. These elite privates believe, for the most part, that these decisions should not be left to computer, that they should be made by humans. And once you decide to turn that process over to humans, it becomes, you know, very subjective, very, you know, messy, very subject to gut feeling. Mm-hmm. And I think I would be hard-pressed, frankly, to design a better system.
With warts and all, I'm thinking of our listeners tonight, and surely there will be many who are thinking of big state schools and heading there and saying, what's all the fuss about? Who cares if you go to those 50 super elite American universities? And others, other families, other students who would give their eye teeth to get into those schools and are planning right now extreme measures to attempt to do that. Why has a portion of American society become so fixated on getting into that very tip-top tier of schools, at least in terms of U.S. news rankings?
I think there's several reasons that are converging. Certainly, you've got first-generation Americans who were perfectly content when they went to college maybe 2 decades ago or more to go to a terrific state university like the University of Massachusetts or Michigan or Virginia. But suddenly, that's not good enough for their kids. They themselves may have achieved great wealth. And yet, the one thing that has eluded them in their lives is the imprint, perhaps, of an Ivy or a similar institution. And so it certainly one of the things that is driving this is parents living through their kids. Another reason certainly is U.S. news. When U.S. news declares a school number one, whether it's Amherst or Princeton, it's the American way. Who wouldn't want to be identified as number one? And so we gravitate to these schools for that reason, in part.
Jack Beatty, we're digging in tonight to the admissions process, but the platform that all this stands on is this incredible fixation on status and rankings in America today.
Yes, it is. A friend of mine who teaches at Stanford tells me that when Stanford plays Berkeley in football, the Stanford kids yell across the stadium, "We got in! We got in!" You know, Berkeley, my God, what could be a better school? So this invidious comparison thing is just woven right into the woof of this, and it seems to trump the educational values in it. In other words, the students themselves get involved in this status seeking, and those who don't get in are hurt, even though materially it'd be hard to argue that the education they'd receive, say, at Berkeley would be inferior. But we have, the society's become more unequal over the last 30 years. Every study documents that. And this selection system, I think, is in some ways ratifying the inequalities in the society rather than trying to correct them. I know it tries, and I know in some cases it does, but that's my big fear about it, that the emphasis on status and on the name of the school and so on, and the pressure from the U.S. news people forces schools really not to discover talent so much as to ratify what's already there.
That's a very interesting perspective. What about it, Jock Steinberg? Do you see the admissions process essentially ratifying status, bestowing status, confirming a status system in American society?
Well, I think, first of all, U.S. news is sort of giving the people what they want. I mean, if nobody bought that issue, it wouldn't exist. And so it's in a way, while I have some questions about how they rank these colleges and what sort of goes into that ranking, it's hard to sort of fault U.S. news for giving the public what they want. But there are certainly kids who are getting into schools like Wesleyan, as well as Harvard and Dartmouth and Yale, who wouldn't have had a prayer of getting in 30-some-odd years ago when these schools were less likely to take a student of color or even a Jewish applicant. So I think there has been a little shaking up a little bit in terms of who gets moved to the front of the line.
The central figure in the book is Ralph Figueroa, an admissions officer at Wesleyan. Tell us about him. What was he looking for as he went about his duties as an admissions guy?
Well, Ralph's looking for a lot of different things. At the time we find him, Ralph is in his mid-30s. He had worked for several years at another college, Occidental. Before that, he was a lawyer. It's certainly not unique in an admissions office to find somebody who's had a different career. In Ralph's office, among the 10 colleagues he had, one colleague had been a California State Humane Officer whose specialty was breaking up fights among pit bulls. That was certainly a talent that came in handy at the admissions office at times. Another woman had been a management and trainee at Sears. Another gentleman had been a resident administrator in a psychiatric halfway house. He had also been a food stamp interviewer.
So why were they chosen? What qualified them? What qualified Ralph to make these momentous decisions about American youth?
I mean, unless it's a school like Caltech, very often the institution puts these decisions in the hands of people with the broadest life experience possible. It's important to remember, and you see this in the gatekeepers repeatedly, these people see themselves first and foremost as social engineers.
And Ralph's mission in particular?
Yes. Well, Ralph has a specific mission. Like everybody else, he's looking for talent and for people with specific things that they can bring to the Wesleyan community or people who would benefit from a Wesleyan education. But Ralph, as somebody who is Hispanic, grew up in California, is charged in part with being the officer in the office who will really evaluate Latino students who are coming to the office. And indeed, the rate of admission of Latino students at Wesleyan is about twice the rate of admission of the class as a whole.
How big a factor did you find race, ethnicity, social background in the selection process?
Again, you have to go back to this idea that they're building a community and they need oboe players in that community. They need tuba players. Tuba players are a perennial shortage area in the Ivies. I'm sure we're going to send all these kids off to tuba lessons tonight just by saying that. But it's true. But in that community, you also need, as Wesleyan and others see it, a critical mass of Hispanic kids, black kids, and Asian American kids. And it's certainly something they pay attention to, but it's hardly the only thing.
Jacques Steinberg, stand by. We're going to come back and talk more about the new book, The Gatekeepers, about the inside story of the college admissions process, the inner world of college admissions. Listeners, does our college admissions process make sense to you? And why is there so much anxiety about college admissions in America today? What's been your family's experience with college applications and admissions? You can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the inside story of the college admissions process, the secret inner world of college admissions. Our guest tonight is Jacques Steinberg. He's a national education correspondent for the New York Times. He wrote a great series for the New York Times about what it takes, what it took, to get into the class of 2004 at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. He's now put that together, plus some, in a new book called The Gatekeepers, Inside the Admissions Process of a Premier College. 8 months of work tracking down that process inside out, every detail, the long, excruciating meetings where young Americans' futures were decided by a handful of people in an admissions office. Is this a fair process, we're asking tonight? Are universities choosing the right students for the right reasons? Just fundamentally, does the system work in your experience? Can you imagine a better way? We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. We're also joined now by Ralph Figueroa. He was the admissions officer at Wesleyan University that Jacques Steinberg followed most closely for his book, The Gatekeepers. He's since left the university. He's now director of college guidance at Albuquerque Academy in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Good evening and welcome, Ralph Figueroa.
Thank you, Tom. Good evening.
Thanks so much for being with us. Ralph, you had Jacques Steinberg dogging you for 8 months. You've seen the book that he's put together. Do you think we've got the right picture here? How would you describe the process of college admissions in America today? Is it effective? Is it fair? Is it social engineering, as Jacques Steinberg suggests?
I think that it is very effective and it is very fair. And I think that Mr. Steinberg gave you a very good picture in his book. The articles themselves that appeared in the Times were a good glimpse of the process and really did a good job of introducing the readers to a very complex process. But in the book, The Gatekeepers, he's able to delve into much more detail and show you all the nuts and bolts. And the one thing I must say about the book is that it really is a very, very accurate portrayal of the system.
Ralph Figueroa, now you're on the other side of the equation. You're advising high school students, I guess, on how to jump through exactly those hoops that you used to control. What do you say to the students, to their families, when they're approaching this challenge? Give us your spiel in brief.
Well, now I'm in the position of being able to tell students that as much as Wesleyan University was a terrific institution and a great institution for some people, that it is not the only institution out there and that they have to broaden their scope. And that's really the key to surviving this process and to doing well in this process, is looking at a wider range of schools than just the top 60 or 50 schools out there that every applicant wants to go to.
What do you think is the reason that there's such a frenzy of interest in those schools now? 7,000 applications in the year that Jacques Steinberg followed for 700 positions. Why that kind of ratio?
Well, it just has a lot to do with what people perceive as being prestigious or being a good value or being a good name to have on that diploma. And it has very little to do, unfortunately, with the actual quality of the education that they get. It's just people's perceptions and the public's perceptions about what is a good school.
Jacques Steinberg, we've got a sense of Ralph's role and of this process as you've described it. But give us a sense of some of the students that you followed, what they brought to the party, what their hopes were, what they invested in their high school experience that they hoped would take them to glory in the application process.
Well, we follow six applicants and the gatekeepers. They're all real. They're details. And each of them, we sort of picked them in part because they represented something larger about the process. One of the most exciting kids to follow was a young woman named Juliana, who goes to a school in Los Angeles, or who went to a school in Los Angeles called Harvard Westlake. I was stunned to learn that Juliana had been on Ralph's radar since the ninth grade. I couldn't imagine that an admissions officer would sort of size up an academic prospect that early, and yet Ralph had.
Why?
What was so exciting about Juliana? In part, it was that not only could she check the box for a white applicant, but also she could check the box for black and for Hispanic. Her father had grown up in the Amazon in Brazil, and her first language was Portuguese. But it was more than just that. Juliana had nearly a perfect SAT score, but she was also a terrific dancer, a great writer, and just an all-around, great person to sort of be around. She was really the social conscience of Harvard Westlake, and this was a school where lots of the kids' last names were Katzenberg and Spielberg. And here was Juliana there, at least partly on scholarship. And Ralph was hardly alone in following her. When she goes into her senior fall, she goes into her college counselor's office. She's got 54 colleges on her wish list. And it's not because she's arrogant. It's just because Ralph is only one of the suitors who are pursuing her. These colleges are bombarding her with mail, and she can't sort through.
Let me ask Ralph about Juliana. Ralph, why were you gunning so hard for Juliana? Was it exactly this combination of a multiracial ethnicity and high talent? And what makes that so precious to a college admissions officer like you?
It was that. She actually caught my eye when she was performing in a performance of West Side Story at her high school, and I was in the audience. Her guidance counselor is a close friend of mine, and I noticed her, and her counselor told me she's not only a good dancer, but she appears to be a really super student. And through my relationship with this guidance counselor, Juliana kept being mentioned over the years as she approached her senior year. And certainly her multi-ethnic background was very attractive, as well as her apparent outstanding academic record. The more I heard about her, the more I knew that she would be an applicant that I would really want to have at Wesleyan.
Jacques Steinberg, you write that Juliana ultimately got in everywhere she applied. The University of Chicago offered her a free ride. Stanford arranged for her to meet Chelsea Clinton as a kind of inducement to come. Her mother went into the Yale financial aid office and wangled a better deal for her. She decided to go to Yale. Wesleyan lost her. What's the significance of this for the application pool, the applying pool of students at large? What does it mean?
Well, certainly there are some students like Juliana, and you don't have to be black, white, and Hispanic with a 1500 to be in this position, who are in a real position to bargain. And some schools will tell you that your scholarship award is based on need. And yet when Juliana's mother went to the Yale financial aid office armed with an award from Stanford and award from Harvard, both of which were lower than what Yale was offering, Yale recalculated her need and decided that she was more needy than they had originally anticipated. And I think it certainly doesn't hurt for parents of kids in demand to know that there can be some bargaining when it comes to financial aid.
Jack Beatty, we hear in all of this a very deliberate effort to create a certain kind of class. On the one hand, we were saying earlier, this confirms a kind of American status system. On the other hand, what's being described here is a busting down of old walls in the status system, is it not?
Yes. I mean, there's no question about that. The SAT, for example, which is many people think now an instrument for exclusion, was in fact invented precisely to bust down those walls by giving one standard to which a student, whereby you could measure a student's merit. I think you can't deny that there are more opportunities for kids from different walks of life. I guess what I'm worried about, and what I tried to get at earlier, was this whole idea of merit, and the idea that somehow merit inheres in intellectual capacity. And this idea, I think, is what is essentially sanctified. I'd go that far. In universities today, and I don't know that it's a wholly healthy idea for a democracy, and I don't know whether that what it measures, intelligence, aptitude for tests, is in fact a measure of merit, or whether rather merit is something that is revealed in effort and in striving and in doing rather than in some sort of test about doing. So I think there's an adoption here of values that are not consistent with democracy, and that doesn't necessarily invalidate them, but that are also questionable in their own right, since they rest on tests and not on the proof of life.
Jacques Steinberg, speak to that point.
I have to tell you that I think that Mr. Beattie will be pleased to learn that the very thing he describes as sort of what he hopes the system will aspire to actually happens at Wesleyan and other colleges that are like it. Ralph will tell you, and Ralph can tell you, that when he looks at an SAT score for every applicant, he uses a different filter. And one of the things that he looks at is the educational attainment of the parents, because there are certainly plenty of studies that show that the SAT measures in part the sort of intellectual stimulation that one gets at home. Mm-hmm. So, for example, somebody like me who grew up in southeastern Massachusetts, white, the son of a doctor, I'm going to be held to the highest standard. There's going to be a hope that I can, or an expectation that I can hit about 1,400 on that 1,600-point scale. Mm-hmm. And yet some of the other kids we follow in the book, particularly one young woman from Washington Heights in Manhattan who is Dominican, whose parents did not go to college, when Ralph reads her file and sees that despite these hurdles she pulled an 1,100, he's not necessarily dissuaded, in part because she had achieved the very things that Mr. Beattie was talking about. She was taking the hardest courses. Indeed, she was attending a really rigorous prep school in Maryland. She had become the president of the student body, even though at this school, one out of every three girls is so wealthy that she brings her own horse to this school. Hmm. And yet this young woman, Aggie, who has nothing, gets to this school and becomes president of the student body.
And she gets high marks for that.
And Ralph gives her high marks for doing the very sort of striving that Mr. Beattie says he hopes the system will build in. And it's not just Wesleyan that's looking for these sorts of things. So the definition of a merit is very, very elastic, depending on which applicant is on the table at the time.
Jack Steinberg, Ralph Figueroa, please stand by. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. Soya is calling from Edinburgh, Pennsylvania. Hi, Soya. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure.
Yes, I just want to point out the fact that, you know, admission offices, I think money is a big part, too, because we tend to see some really, you know, rich kids going to Harvard and all those schools, so I would like you to comment on that.
Well, let's do exactly that. Ralph Figueroa, how about it? Soya says it looks to him like money is the bottom line or a big factor here. What about that?
Sometimes it can be.
How so?
A friend of mine, as a student, was working in an admission office and received a call from an angry parent who was sure that someone else at her daughter's school had gotten in because of large donations, and she assured them that that was never going to be the case. She learned to her chagrin, once the admission officer took the call, that you never say never in the admissions business. Sometimes money can play a factor. Admissions offices sometimes do have to handle wealthy alumni or wealthy donors, and sometimes decisions do get made as a quote-unquote development case.
And what about a more systematic awareness of money? When you sit around the table making your final decisions, are you paying attention to who can pay the full freight and who cannot?
We are not, and that is schools like Wesleyan, which are fortunate enough to be need-blind in their admission process, meaning that they do not consider who can pay in making that decision. Once a student has been admitted, then you look at the finances and determine who needs financial assistance, and Wesleyan is able to meet that full financial assistance for those students.
So it sounds in that case like money counts if it's big enough, potentially.
Exactly, and that's what I was getting at, that in some certain cases, and a small number of those, big money can count, but on a day-to-day basis, money is not regarded. But then again, there are only a few institutions that are fortunate enough to be able to have need-blind admissions, as Wesleyan does.
Jason's on the line. Welcome, Jason. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. I wanted to make a few points and ask you to comment. One is, it seems like you make a distinction between the admissions policies of the top-tier schools and the other ones in terms of individual attention. So it would seem that there's actually more opportunity for disadvantaged people at the top-tier schools because they actually look at candidates' backgrounds and so on as opposed to just mm-hmm. using scores.
That is the suggestion. Let's pick that up first, Jason. Jacques Steinberg, how about that?
I think it's hard to generalize, but the fact is that, as Ralph says, these are schools that can often afford to bring tremendous resources to an applicant like this. They have said that applicants of color with disadvantaged backgrounds are prized as members of their community.
But you characterized earlier the state school approach as putting the scores and grades into a computer and outcome the list. Is it really that simple, or do state schools also exercise this kind of discretionary consideration of applicants?
Well, at Michigan, for example, there's a 150-point scale, and there's some sort of a rough cutoff. And they factor in these very things I describe, SAT scores, class rank, grade point average, mm-hmm. and yet they also will give you an extra 20 points for being black or Hispanic or being white and disadvantaged. And that system is in all likelihood going to be evaluated by the U.S. Supreme Court, perhaps sometime in the next year or so.
With an eye to see whether or not it's valid. Jason, you had another point or two.
Yeah, the other point was you it seems like you downplay the importance of going to a top-tier school versus other schools. And I guess I would question whether or not it's true that you don't get a significantly better education at a smaller liberal arts college, say, versus a large state school, and the recruiting opportunities. I mean, where does Goldman Sachs recruit? Do they recruit at a large state school, or do they recruit at the top 10? And so it would seem that it does make some sense to pay attention to trying to get into those schools if you can't.
That's a good hard question. Jason, thanks for raising it. Ralph Figueroa, how about that? We've got great state schools in this country. We've got these elite schools that Jock Steinberg's writing about. How much does it matter in very real material terms to students which they go to?
It does matter a bit. There is some difference. There are some advantages, as Jason points out, to going to a top-tier school or going to a higher-regarded school. And yet, the opportunities are there at the state schools as well. It depends more, in the end, on the student himself or herself, the opportunities that they're willing to pursue, the activities that they're willing to engage in, how much they're willing to push the circumstances and the opportunities that they're given at that state school.
Mm-hmm. Chris is on the line. Welcome, Chris. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you very much. I want to respond to the point that Jack Beatty made about this is all really about merit. Mm. And when I heard the chap who had been at Wesleyan talk, he was talking about someone who had a terrific background, but she spoke three different languages and had three different ethnicities. And in my own case, you know, my daughter is Celto-American. And, you know, I don't know if that's...
Aaron Gobra.
Exactly. And I guess I don't know if that's quite interesting enough for someone who seems to be apparently shopping for something that looks interesting or tastes interesting. It sounds like someone at a very high-class restaurant ordering from a menu because that might be fun to eat.
Yeah.
These are people, mm-hmm. these are human beings, mm-hmm. and merit, you know, is a very subjective thing. Is it meritorious to have been born from an interesting background? I don't think so. If that were the case, then Prince Charles would automatically go to the front of the line. And he was, you know, really not the best student at wherever he went to school.
Well, you put this case very, very sweetly, Chris, and let me put it to Ralph Figueroa. What about it, Ralph? It sounds to Chris like you're looking for the foie gras on the menu and you know, some other less exotic dish but very solid of great ingredients may not be of interest to a college admissions officer like you were.
At times it does seem that way. At times it does seem that students need to find the so-called hook, as they say in the admissions business. If it's not background, then it has to be some talent, whether it's artistic ability or athletic ability. You have to allow the college admission staff to see the information and to gather the information and try to make the best decision and see if they can find what your particular student adds that nobody else does. And it's hard because sometimes it does seem that it is a drive to find those specialties that are more exotic.
Jock Steinberg, how about it? Does it leave the Celto-American out in the cold unless they can tap dance on the ceiling and ride three horses?
I think that there is at times a higher burden that white students of means must meet, but they're not looking at Wesleyan. I mean, Ralph is exemplary and an example of the other admissions officers at Wesleyan, but not every admissions officer at Wesleyan has in their portfolio keeping an eye out for Latino applicants. And the committee that is making these decisions is as diverse as the student body they're trying to assemble. And Chris should take take some comfort in the fact that there are some people on this committee who are Celto-American and who are looking for the very children that sound like his daughter described.
Chris, thanks for your call. Jack Steinberg, stand by. We're talking tonight about the inside story of the college admissions process. How are you preparing your high school child for this wild ride? You can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website and click on Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the inside story of the college admissions process. Our guest is Jacques Steinberg, who took a series of articles on the application procedure at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, and turned it into a new book called The Gatekeepers. And Ralph Figueroa, who was the college admissions officer that Jacques Steinberg followed most closely in putting those stories, that book together. Jacques Steinberg, I want to... Oh, Jack, are you there?
Yeah. I actually was an admissions officer once in my life at a public university. And I just want to say that we did individually look at applicants and interview many of them. It wasn't just by computers. And I felt, and in retrospect, I feel even more strongly, that we were able to take more of a chance than, say, a private school could on a student who might be a diamond in the rough, no visible signs of academic excellence, but in an interview or in a composition or in a teacher's recommendation or something, someone could say, this kid needs scope. Give him a chance. And, you know, we hear from these gentlemen about, yes, they'll let in the kid with the 1,000 points in the SAT, but the fact is they can only let in so many without bumping up against the U.S. News ranking. Every time they let in someone whose SATs are just a little bit lower, they're lowering their status on that ranking. So I think that's one of the things that closes the gate in these schools.
Jacques Steinberg, how do you see the impact of the U.S. News rankings on the selection process?
I certainly didn't see U.S. News as a factor in the early rounds of the process when Ralph is sort of sitting on his porch in the cold reading 30 applicants a day, in effect recommend rejecting three before he can admit one. In the late rounds of the process, when, say, there are 100 seats left to go and there are 400 applicants left that they can't decide on and they're meeting as a committee, certainly they look at some of the things that Mr. Beatty describes. They will talk about score profile. Score profile is a euphemism for where is our median SAT score of this class as it stands now. As we make these final choices, are we running above where we were last year so U.S. News will be pleased, or are we running below? And if they're running above, which was the case in the class of 2004, they were able to take the very chances that Mr. Beatty describes having taken at a public university.
And if they weren't, they'd go for those scores. Jennifer's on the line. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hi. I went to the University of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Right now I'm 31, so I've been out for a while.
Okay.
But I was really groomed by my family to go to an Ivy League school, and that was really a very important point in my family. I was encouraged to be on the varsity tennis team, which I did, and I did a lot of clay sculpture, and my parents took photos of it, and that was part of my college application process.
And how did it turn out, Jennifer?
Well, ironically, I think that I got a really wonderful education, but I think that I was also very unhappy during college. I mean, generally, just as a human being. Because I was so groomed around developing certain talents with the sole purpose of getting into an Ivy League school, there wasn't a lot of room left for me to really develop who I am.
That goes right to the heart of it. Jennifer, thank you for calling. Jack Steinberg, what about it? Your own newspaper made this point in its review. It concludes looking at the book by saying, today's cutthroat competition in college admissions has less to do with real educational value than with a market-driven scramble for perceived value in an academic world where the difference between reality and perception is breaking down.
I think Jennifer is not alone. We follow an applicant in the book named Jordan from Staten Island who thinks that his life will be over if he doesn't get into an Ivy, Brown and Penn in particular. I think that they really try to measure the passion that kids have for their activities, trying to assess whether this was indeed something that you enjoyed and that you did for the sort of sake of doing. But I think from the applicant's point of view, it's easy for me to sit back and say that Jennifer's parents should have been more lenient and let her take some chances in the colleges she applied to. And yet here I sit as somebody who attended Dartmouth College and wanted to go there very badly. Mm-hmm. And I would come off as hypocritical as saying I didn't have some of the feelings that that Jennifer had going up.
Ralph Figueroa, how about it? When you look at those fancy applications with all the activities, how do you measure the passion, the reality of the experience that's being put on display?
Yeah, we're trying to find people who do have that genuine devotion to their activities and are going to bring that to the campus when we admit them. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people out there like Jennifer who are pushed to go into a certain direction and end up not having the best experience, even if they're at a place that's supposed to be one of the best in the world or the country.
Chuck Steinberg, take us into the final rounds. When the admissions officers are sitting around the table, they're making those final decisions, what are they looking for then?
It's an amazing thing to watch. I mean, almost every file has been read by two admissions officers, and there's sort of these 400 that are left for about 100 offers of acceptance. And what happens is this sort of lightning round where you get one more chance as an applicant to give them a reason to take you. And so what they do is they meet for 5 days as a committee and consider 80 cases a day in 5-minute rapid-fire intervals, almost like a prosecutor. Hmm. The chair of the committee will present the case, read grades, extracurricular activities, what your alumni interviewer said about you. It comes so fast you can't believe it.
And then it's thumbs up, thumbs down right there.
Ultimately, there is a brief discussion, and then let's have a show of hands, majority rules. On the one hand, it is nerve-wracking to sort of watch this and think these decisions are being made so quickly. On the other hand, the files have already been considered, and this is one last chance to make sure, are we making a mistake? Are we missing somebody? Were we not fair to this person when we considered them the first two times?
And you've got to wonder, after all that tension, all that pressure, exactly how much it really matters. Yes, it matters, but is it really life-shaping? Chuck Steinberg, I want to thank you so much for doing the book and for coming on with us tonight to talk about it.
Thank you, Tom.
Chuck Steinberg is author of the new book, The Gatekeepers, Inside the Admissions Process of a Premier College. And Ralph Figueroa, joining us tonight from Albuquerque, New Mexico, thanks for sharing your inside experience with us.
You're welcome, Tom.
Ralph Figueroa was an admissions officer at Wesleyan University, followed by Chuck Steinberg for 8 months. He's now director of college guidance at Albuquerque Academy in Albuquerque, New Mexico. This is On Point. On Point's audio archaeologist Ned Connors digs up songs and sounds from the last century for our program. Tonight, on Veterans Day, he shares a story of discovery and the voices of soldiers and sailors from World War II.
Hello, Mom and Pop, Eileen and Bobby. How are you?
About 15 years ago, while poking around in a box at a second-hand store, I found an odd-looking 78 RPM record. It was made of flexible cardboard with a plastic coating, and it was stuffed in a mailing envelope, addressed to a family near Boston. The cancel stamp said 1943. Later that night, I took it out of the envelope and played it. A young sailor's voice filled the room. It was a talking letter to his family.
I guess you're pretty surprised to get this, but we were up here at the USO and we saw the sign about having records made, so I thought we'd all run up here and get it. We're up here for the weekend in Seattle. There's about five of us. We've been having a very good time, going to dances and went out to the campus.
It was a strange experience. These words were intended for his family, not for me. I listened on and felt a chill. It hit me that this kid may have never made it home. These words may have been the last ones his family ever heard.
It seems like we're on the other side of the world, way out here in Washington. It's pretty nice, except the sun never shines. And how's everything at home?
I was curious as to how this and other amateur recordings from World War II came to be made. In the late 1930s, just as Europe entered the war, few American companies began producing inexpensive tabletop phonographs with home recording units built in. You could cut your own records. When the war began, these machines were pressed into service for the morale effort. In 1941, Jem Razorblades and the Packard Bell Company started sending roving recorders out to military bases where GIs often queued up in all-night recording sessions to send a reassuring word home before shipping out. By mid-1942, the USO and Pepsi Cola had set up canteens where GIs could get a hot cup of coffee, a shave, and make a record to mail home. The Red Cross provided blank discs and recording machines to military hospitals throughout the country. Millions of these records were made during the war years. There aren't many left. The records are often unlabeled and long separated from their mailing envelopes. No date, no location, no idea who made them. Over the years, these 78s were discarded, tucked away in drawers, mixed in with commercial recordings, and forgotten. But once in a while, they turn up at flea markets or yard sales, mixed in with commercial records. Most of them are solo, a cappella renditions of popular songs of the day. Here's a group of GIs singing their version of Glenn Miller's 1941 hit, Chattanooga Choo Choo.
Get your dinner on the dinner, now it's a good fire. Fast you have your ham and eggs and caterol lined up. When you hear the whistle blow and they do the bar, then you know the Tennessee is not very far.
Nurses and canteen volunteers often joined in songs with guys that only met a few minutes earlier. Sometimes they sang solos to families they didn't even know.
One of the girls here we're with is going to sing Embrace While You for me, and we've got another fellow here who used to work in a broadcasting company. He's going to introduce her. So don't forget to save these records when I get home so I can listen to them myself.
This program is transcribed from a retreating broadcast of the Columbia Broadcasting System. We now present Esther Hazen singing Embraceable You. Esther?
Mm-hmm. Embrace me, my sweet embraceable you. Embrace me.
If it weren't for the war, many GIs would have married their high school sweethearts and never left their hometowns. In this 1943 record, labeled to Jeanette from Ray, you can hear her broken heart.
All I can do is say that I love you, and I ever will, and till I die. I wish I was back home with you, and always to stay with you. I wish I could hold you in my arms and kiss you again once more like we used to, and make love to you like we used to, and go places like we used to, and I'm starting to hate the Navy now.
Our enemies also use the new portable recording technology in their battle for hearts and minds. As part of its propaganda effort, the Japanese government brought recorders into the prison camps and recorded scripted messages from Allied prisoners. They then beamed them over shortwave to the Pacific coast. In June 1944, someone in California caught this broadcast and re-recorded it. Here's Radio Man First Class Otis Musselwhite, U.S. Navy, captured in Guam, sending a shortwave message from a Japanese prison camp to his mother in Cordelia, Georgia.
I am in good health and my weight is normal. I've received some mail, Red Cross food, and clothing, for which I am very grateful. I wish especially to say hello to Ms. Lee Riley of 110 Magnolia Avenue, Mill Bay, California. Lee, please notify my mother and family of this broadcast and tell them I am fine and they have nothing to worry about. Also, please tell Mrs. Dorothy...
Sometimes we're lucky enough to find out a little background on a recording. Private Joe Petrucci served with the 83rd Infantry and sent records home to his family in Providence, Rhode Island. Joe landed at Normandy in 1944 and fought his way across France and Germany. He's got a photo of himself sitting in the office at Hitler's Eagle's Nest compound. Here's Private Petrucci singing Coming In on a Wing and a Prayer.
Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Though there's one more to go, we can still carry on. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. What a show, what a fun.
I think my favorite wartime home recording is one made by a young man from East Providence, Rhode Island, who wrote and sang, I'm Hanging My Saddle on the Old Ranch House Door. It's about a cowboy leaving behind his buddies and his horse to fight Hitler. These records don't offer much for military historians. Mentions of the big issues, troop movements, or destination was prohibited. What they do offer is a very human, heartwarming look at a country at war and the hopeful, youthful voices of a heroic generation now passing from the American scene.
Hello, Mom and Dad. This is me again.
I'll leave you with a soldier recuperating in Ward 17 at the Camp Edwards Military Hospital, singing, I Wish I Knew. I wish we knew how to thank them all.
I wish I knew someone like you could love me. I wish I knew you place no one above me. Did I mistake this for a real romance?
Ned Connors is On Point's audio archaeologist. He lives in Barrington, Rhode Island. To read more about talking letters, visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Why let me hope and pray so? Don't lead me on. If I'm a fool, just say so.